Hey everyone, this is William Catt from The Greatest American Hero, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, Comic Book Nation. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, where in just a few short minutes, I will be welcoming my special guest from The Greatest American Hero, William Catt. Now, a few things to get to before that. First, it's a sad week here in the lair. As many of you know, a legendary voice was silenced this week. American Top 40 host Casey Kasem passed away. Now, for fans of animation, we all knew and loved Casey as Norville Shaggy Rogers on just about every Scooby-Doo series. And Casey also provided the voice of Robin, the Boy Wonder, on the Batman-Superman Hour in the 60s and Super Friends in the 70s. So sorry to see him go, but he has certainly left behind a legacy of voice work that we can appreciate in the years to come. Now, be sure to stay tuned to Comic Book Central in the coming weeks because I recently sat down with Casey's Super Friends co-star, Shannon Farnan, who voiced Wonder Woman on the series. We spoke before Casey passed away, and she was able to share her memories both professionally and personally of Casey. I think that's going to be a nice little tribute to him, so look for that episode coming soon. I also want to mention that if you are an Indiana Jones fan, be sure to check out the latest episode of the IndieCast. It's hosted by Ed Dalista, and it's where Keith Voss and I will wrap up our review of Marvel Comics' 1980 series, The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones. 34 issues, we wrapped it up. But we're going to be moving on to the Dark Horse years, so don't worry, we're going to have some more adventures. But you can find that segment on iTunes and at theindiecast.com. Also, I want to let you know that this weekend I'm headed out of the lair and getting my scary on with producer and host of Monster Kid Radio, Derek Cook, as we head to Monster Bash in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Now, some of you know Derek and I have been breaking down the Abbott and Costello Meet the Monsters series of films over on Derek's podcast, MonsterKidRadio.net. This weekend, we'll be meeting up with the boys themselves, Abbott and Costello. Well, in the form of comedians Joe Ziegler as Lou Costello and Bill Riley as Bud Abbott. That's going to be very, very fun. And they're going to be part of an Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein tribute with a recreation of McDougal's House of Horrors. It's going to be amazing. You'll hear all about it on the show in the weeks to come. I also want to mention that also attending will be Beverly Washburn from Superman and the Mole Men, The Lone Ranger, and the original Star Trek series. Another attendee will be Julie Adams from Steve Canyon, also the Incredible Hulk TV series, and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And one of my all-time favorite comedians is going to be there, straight from the satellite of love, Mystery Science Theater 3000's Joel Hodgson. It is going to be a blast again. You're going to hear about my adventures at Monster Bash in the weeks to come. And if you're in the Pittsburgh area this weekend, be sure to stop by and say hi. You can get all the details on the event at monsterbashnews.com. And I'm going to be meeting some amazing folks at that convention. One other convention you need to know about will be taking place this August 15th through the 17th at the Webster Bank Arena in Bridgeport, Connecticut. It's Connecticut Comic Con, and it's run by none other than my other pal on the IndieCast, Mitch Halleck.
Unleash your power when Connecticut Comic Con hits the Webster Bank Arena. There'll be celebrity guests, legendary comic book creators, famous movies and TV vehicles. Shop for comics, collectibles, and cool stuff. Dress as your favorite character and enter costume contests for kids and adults. Meet your favorite voice actors and see a reunion of the cast of the Thundercats. Tickets on sale now, online, and at the arena box office. Join us on August 15th through 17th for Connecticut Comic-Con. 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 Comic-Con.
Making a special appearance at Connecticut Comic-Con this year will be none other than my guest in the lair today, William Catt. If you want to meet William in person, start making those plans now. And in the meantime, you can check out my conversation with the man who took to the skies and flapped his arms in a frenzy as the greatest American hero. I'm telling you, this is absolutely one of my favorite television series of all time. Created by the prolific writer-producer Stephen J. Cannell, featuring the great Robert Culp as FBI agent Bill Maxwell, the lovely Connie Selleca as attorney Pam Davidson, the Lois Lane to Ralph Hinckley's Superman, the greatest American hero, the brilliantly funny William Catt. It's not too difficult to see how William Catt was first introduced to the acting profession. His father, Bill Williams, roamed the Wild West on his trusty steed, Apache, as the star of the hit TV series, The Adventures of Kit Carson. His mother, Barbara Hale, starred as Della Street, secretary to Raymond Burr's Perry Mason on the long-running series and 30 TV movies. William's early roles included guest spots in some of the 70s' biggest series, MASH, Kung Fu, Gunsmoke, many, many others. And he hit the big time with memorable roles in Brian De Palma's horror film, Carrie, and on the Broadway stage as the title character in Pippin. But for fans of superheroes, we're glad he caught the eye of mega producer Stephen J. Cannell, who, after creating many of television's biggest crime dramas, was given the challenge of developing a superhero show for ABC.
Here I am, I'm a successful television executive, I've got three shows on the air, and now I gotta go put on a spandex suit with a little jockey underwear and a cape and run around in public. I'm dead, it's over. I'll never sell another show, they're gonna lock me up. And that, I thought, that is funny. So I thought, if I just hit this with hard reality, you know, I just take this whole genre and hold it up to the light, just say, what would a real guy do? Wouldn't he quit when he got threatened? I mean, what would a real guy do if you had to, like, wear this suit around in public? That's a funny scene to write.
The Greatest American Hero premiered in 1981, and it was infused with action, a sharp sense of humor and satire, crazy, hilarious stunt work and special effects, a cast with some of the most incredible chemistry television has ever seen, and an infectious top 10 theme song by Joey Scarberry.
Taking a big leap from 7 to 4 is Joey Scarberry with the theme from the TV show Greatest American Hero. His first hit is called Believe It or Not.
The show featured a realistic take on a single-parent high school teacher, Katz Ralph Hinckley, dealing with the pressures of being granted superpowers by the little green guys from outer space. The series ran for 3 seasons, got a chance to wrap things up a few years later when Ralph turns the red jammies over to the Greatest American Heroine, and William brought the theme of comic books full circle when he released his take on the origin of the supersuit in a 3-issue comic book miniseries from Catastrophic Comics. Well, every now and again on Comic Book Central, I get to be a little selfish and introduce a guest that provides a direct injection of pure nostalgia for me. Today is absolutely one of those days. From one of my favorite shows of all time, The Greatest American Hero, it's William Catt. William, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Hey, man. Happy to be here.
Now, I'm wondering if we're ever going to see a Greatest American Hero soundtrack with Joey Scarberry's cover tunes from the show and maybe Billy Catt singing a new version of the theme song. What do you think?
I think that's very, very doubtful at this point.
Is Billy Catt going to make a comeback on the music scene anytime soon?
Oh, God, no. I play with a bunch of guys. You know, we all have day jobs, but I play with a bunch of guys every week. I've been playing for years. We play all the time. Once in a while, we play out, but mainly it's just we do it for our own enjoyment. It's our bowling night, I like to call it.
Yeah, do you have shirts?
Yeah,
it's like matching shirts.
We should. No, we have the shoes though.
We're working
our way up from our feet to our head, you know.
The album was Secret Smiles. Yeah, he capitalized on the success of The Greatest American Hero. Was that you originally kind of thought you were going to go in that direction though, right? As a singing career when you first started out?
Yeah, you know, everything went. I actually went to school and studied music theory and composition for a while, and I kind of headed in that direction, and I've never given up that passion, but it's always been a hobby most of my life, you know, just something I do instead of crossword puzzles.
That's a little bit different, but as many people know, you come from an acting background. Did your parents encourage you to go into show business?
From a very early age, they were kind of accepting of the whole arena. That's where I grew up. All their friends were actors and musicians, and so I kind of grew up in that world. And I found my way onto the sets once in a while, and I would do something as a kid here and there. But when I got older, it was mainly they wanted me to go to school first and foremost. And then if I wanted to pursue it, then, of course, they were amenable to that.
You didn't make it onto the old Batman TV show set, did you?
I did not. Doggone. No.
You came. Well, your dad was on there, right?
I don't know that my dad ever did Batman.
I think he was on, it was a two-part Penguin-centric episode, Find Finny Friends. He played the millionaire, or played one of the millionaires in the crowd there.
You're like as good as James, you're like a... You're like really good, man.
We go deep, especially with the comic book stuff. And of course, he was Kit Carson on The Adventures of Kit Carson.
Yeah, and he did a series with Betty White, actually, called Date with an Angel. They ran a season or two.
Oh, the great Bill Williams. And of course, your mother, the legendary Barbara Hale.
Yeah.
She played Perry Mason's Secretary Della Street, 250 episodes, 30 TV movies. Can that be right?
Yeah, that is right.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. And you got to work with your mom quite a few times.
Yeah, I did. She was actually, Frank Sinatra's first on-screen kiss. And she worked with James Cagney and Jimmy Stewart and Bob Cummings, a lot of great people. Yeah.
Yeah, and was your dad in a Jimmy Stewart movie? I'm a huge Jimmy Stewart fan. I was was it The Stratton Story or something like that, I think?
Yeah,
was
I think so. I think that was it. Yeah, I'm a huge Jimmy Stewart fan.
Oh, what kind of stories did you get from just like being around your parents? And just, I mean, it had to be just a very different world. I mean, normal for you because that's what you were raised in. But what was that like to just sort of be surrounded by that Hollywood royalty all the time?
You know, I didn't know the difference. You know, the only stories I ever heard were people that made a lot of money and then eventually ended up spending it all and not working. You know, going bankrupt. There was a lot of that going on. Same thing holds true today, you know. You start making money as when you're younger and you think it's going to last forever, then all of a sudden, the work dries up.
And still you pursued an acting career in spite of...
I know. What an idiot was I, you know?
Let's talk about some of those early roles then. Stage roles and things like that. What were we looking at?
Well, it was kind of a circuitous kind of route that it took me there. But, I the music led me in there because I was doing... studying music at school, Orange Coast College, and I found my way with a part-time job at South Coast Repertory, working the soundboard for them when they were doing productions. Now, South Coast Repertory has become a very, very prestigious Lort Theater Company. They've won several Tony Awards now in the ensuing years. It was opened originally by David Ems and Martin Benson. And they were like a small brother to ACT up in Seattle, Bill Ball's wonderful theater. And that's where I got all of my training and it led me into the theater. I did my first role was Young Fisher and We Bombed in New Haven in 1969. And I kind of stayed involved in the theater for a long, long time, up until just a few years ago, I was doing theater every single year, my whole career.
Is that your favorite venue?
I love the theater when I have the time and availability to go do it. You know, it just takes such a long time, and typically it's out of town. I haven't worked in Los Angeles in the theater in an awfully long time. I was at the Pasadena Playhouse in a film thing called Bicoastal Woman. That was like in 2005 or 2006. That was the last time I did theater here in L.A.
Now, two different worlds there, too, because at least with television and movies, you get time to get it down, to get it right. But then you've got the immediate reaction from the audience on the stage. Do you just enjoy both worlds, or is there one that you're like, you know what, I really dig the vibe on this one?
Well, film and television, primarily films, taking me all over the world I've been in the business about 45 years now. It's taken me all over the world. I've seen, Sri Lanka and India and Thailand and Kuala Lumpur and the and other parts of the Orient and overseas and, Europe and Africa. I've been to Africa 6 times. So it's been wonderful to get out there and do that. So I love that aspect of it. But I love the stage and in particular is the rehearsal period. For me, is the most gratifying because you're really solving a puzzle during that 3 or 4 week period of time when you're rehearsing, and that's very fulfilling for me.
Yeah, I would imagine just as an actor, just getting that immediate response and then just adjusting to things that happen too. Especially now, cell phones go off, all kinds of crazy things. You talk about traveling a little bit. Where did you shoot Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend?
Well, that was in the Ivory Coast. For Disney, and that was just a wonderful experience working with. Actually, I got along with Sean Young. I was one probably Well, a lot of people like Sean. I like Sean. We didn't get along initially, but then we ended up being pretty good friends. And I had a terrific time down there. It was quite an adventure, I'll tell you.
It's a great-looking film, and 8 years before Jurassic Park. So you didn't even have the benefit of all the computer graphics and everything.
No. I think the great Bill Norton directed that, and I think to his chagrin, we did not have access to all of that. It was just a little premature, but it was a really interesting story. And I got to work with McGowan, who was a wonderful actor from lots of shows that I liked, a wonderful British actor. And I had a nice time. I wish the baby had been a little bit more sophisticated.
It was 85 and shooting in 84. So, you know, you do. Well, maybe it's time for a reboot. Everybody's doing reboots now and dinosaurs are big. So, yeah, go for it. Maybe you can produce and direct a reboot of that. What are some of the roles that your early roles you're most known for? I'm guessing probably conventions. People come up to you for Carrie and
yeah,
a lot
that's
of different things
Carrie,
like that.
American Hero, and the other one would be House that I did. Steve Miner, wonderful, wonderful director. Steve Miner did that House, and it became quite a cult classic.
The with first Norm one. From Cheers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
George Wendt,
wonderful guy.
Yeah. So that, I mean, so, yeah, you're kind of hitting those genre projects early on. Is that what you enjoyed gravitating toward, or those sort of like larger than life roles?
No, I don't know. I think that was what was offered at the time, you know. Between the time I did Carrie and I ended up on Greatest American Hero, the few films that I did, there was three or four other films that were pay or play deals that never got made that probably would have changed the course of my career, but it didn't happen. So one thing led to another. You know, you pick up you just follow the trail that is laid down in front of you. And some of it you make yourself, and some of it you just, it's a found trailhead. And that's the way life goes, you know?
And then before you know it, you're given the script by the late, great Stephen J. Cannell.
Yeah.
The greatest American hero. What did you think when you first got that script? Did you get a sense, superhero, before you even read it? Like the title, and it's like, whoa, what's this?
Yeah, it was my agent at the time, Michael Black, presented that to me. I was on stage in New York with Diana Wiest and a number of people from the Guthrie Theater. They had brought a play up there. It was the last season at the Phoenix Repertory in off Broadway in New York. And we were down there doing that play. And Steve sent me that script. I read it, and Michael Black promised me. He said, if you want to consider doing this, I'm sure that it won't last more than two or three episodes, and you'll be back, and you can go to New York and be on stage again. And that is not what happened, because it turned out to be quite a hit. We aired, I believe, right after the Super Bowl that year, and it was just had huge, huge ratings.
Now, obviously, at this point, we're coming in after the Christopher Reeve Superman movies. You had George Reeves on television typecast. Were there any concerns at all about putting on spandex, even if it's like, hey, this could go away in a few episodes? I still might be out there forever in this.
Yeah, well, of course, I had all those concerns, and I did pass on it a couple times, and then I was talked into it. And when Steve Cannell, he flew out to New York, and he took me out to dinner early on in the run of the play, and he's such a likable, affable, charismatic, and very, very smart and talented guy that it's hard to say no to that when it's sitting in front of you, you know?
So you had passed on it a couple times, but Steven specifically wanted you for the role?
Yeah, God only knows why. I mean, he had something in mind, and I didn't have to audition for that.
Did you ever find out? I mean, did you ask, like, whoa, why me?
I don't know. It was it worked. You know, it was kind of lightning in a bottle, the chemistry between Bob Culp and myself and Connie Selica. I mean, it was just like, it was pretty magic. Even now when you see it all these many years later, the chemistry is just pretty neat to watch on screen, you know?
Oh, it's amazing. It just, that's, like you said, lightning in a bottle. It comes in like that. Now, of all the characters you played, is Ralph Hinckley the closest to your personality, would you say?
Yeah, he's an aspect of my personality. I mean, I think I'm a pretty likable guy, and I can be funny. But I always play that role. Yeah, I always play the truth in everything I do, whether I'm doing that or a bad guy. But, you know, Ralph was probably, ranks up there in the top two or three of the projects that I really enjoyed doing. It was a lot of fun, you know.
You didn't really have to look deep to find motivation for those early scenes when you have the suit on, right? In the pilot episode.
No. When Ralph looks in the mirror and he's got the suit on for the first time and he goes, "Hi, sailor," and he's like, drops his head down. But that wasn't Ralph. That was Bill Catt going, "There goes my career," you know. But
when you're putting that on, what's going through your mind at that point? I mean, when did you first see the suit? Like, when did you know, oh boy?
It wasn't but a few days before that, because
you're already locked in, ready to go.
Locked in, and then when I put it on, it's like the reality of it hit me square in the face. It's like, dude, you are a cartoon, man.
My wife and I just watched the pilot again last night.
Let me couch that in that this is long before we had the Ed Nortons and the Robert Downeys and those kind of wonderful, fantastic actors doing superheroes, you know.
It's cool now.
Now everybody wants that, you know, because they want that franchise. But back then it was just like a horrible thing to happen.
Yeah, you know? Well, you're coming off the strength, too, of the Superman movies. So was there – and there a lot of Superman references in that pilot, too. Did you kind of get a sense of where did all those come from? Or did you come up with some of them? Or was it all Steven? Or did you kind of like, oh, let's get a phone booth joke in here somewhere?
No, most of that was scripted. But, you know, like any smart writer, Cannell always left room for improv. And we did a lot of improving on the stage. And you know, some of it worked and some of it didn't work. And, he was the man, and, he made he always chose right. It worked.
I'm guessing there was a lot of improv between you and Robert Culp. Again, just, let's talk a little bit about him. We had a chance to interview his son, Joseph, who sounds a lot like his dad.
He does, doesn't he?
I mean, it just, there's a couple of times he'd say something and you just hear that Robert Culp voice, you know, that cadence, those line reads sometimes too. But talk about working with Robert Culp. Initially, it's again, you probably didn't have to dig deep for the motivation of that friction between the characters.
No, I think, well, Bob, you know, that was very close to Bob. I mean, Bob was this grizzled guy, you know, who was jaded and felt underappreciated by the industry. You know, like the industry had kind of turned its back on him. So he brought all that to bear in the role. And, I think he was, pretty methody that he didn't like me initially, which made me, of course, you know, not like him. And, but that all worked. And when you see the early parts of Greatest American Hero, I mean, that worked. The two leads just didn't like each other, but they were forced to work together. That's kind of a formula that's been tried and true. And, in this case, it worked as well. We ended up being very, very good friends, you know?
Yeah. Well, do you think that at those initial episodes then, do you think that was method acting, or was there something seriously that he didn't like about you, you know, William Catt as a person?
I have no idea, except maybe I was on the first title card and he was second. But you know, and I say that with a lot of humor, ultimately, Bob loved that show, and he wanted it to continue on, you know.
Yeah.
At the end of that show, we were offered a couple more years on the air, and I didn't do it. And so Bob got a hold of that gal and tried to have a go at it with the Greatest American Heroine, but it just didn't work.
Yeah. Now, that's even in the pilot, I mean, that really plays into it, because he wanted the red jammies. He thought he should have had the red jammies, and he's like, "Why did? Why does Ralph Hinckley have to get these?" So, in that pilot, my wife and I just watched it again last night. Just, you know, I was getting ready for the interview too, and it holds up. It really holds up after all these years. And I say that along with like the Incredible Hulk, Kenneth Johnson's The Incredible Hulk pilot, this is one of the strongest television pilots I've ever seen. First frame, I mean, you're dealing with religious cultists and undercover FBI agents being targeted, and the guy comes back from the dead, and the little green guys, all these things going on. But then even the human elements of it, being a single parent, you know, going through divorce, juvenile delinquency, the kids you're dealing with, Looking at those scripts, what did you think, and what were the conversations you had with Stephen J. Cannell about where these characters were going and how can we work these real life situations into this?
The only conversation Steve and I ever had about any of that was that he promised me that there would be no, like, we wouldn't end up chasing monsters through the sewers and that kind of, it wouldn't become Mothra, you know? ultimately toward the second season, that's what it was starting to become. It really annoyed me because it was a much smarter show than that. And Bob wrote some wonderful scripts, you know, and we thought it should be more of a, used as a forum, for satire, poke some fun at our political system and some of the situations in the world in a funny way, of course, you know?
Yeah, we talked about that with Joseph, those two episodes that he wrote, Lilacs, Mr. Maxwell, and Vanity Says the Preacher, which turned out to be the final episode of the series. Yeah, very politically charged.
Well, Bob had a couple other scripts, too, that I have them here in my closet in my garage that never got made.
For The Greatest American Hero?
Yeah, uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well,
that was a shame too. Both good, you know. And one was like, you know, had the show run another couple of years, and I think we would have really, it would have become a better show, you know.
Well, you had the comic book out recently as well, too. Was it Catastrophic Comics a few years ago? It ended with the instruction book was actually found by the bad guys. The suit came to life. Are we ever going to see a continuation of that, and maybe those scripts as well?
I don't know. I'm not so sure. I think that 20th Century Fox has the licensing rights now to that show, and there's no dealing with them in terms of getting any kind of rights. You know, it's either all or nothing. And I think that they would rather just keep that locked away in case that they want to do a remake and do a big feature film out of that. So I don't think we'll ever see that again.
Speaking of Robert Culp, where did the dog biscuits come from?
I think that was just Bob. I think he just picked it up on the set one day and started eating them, and it became like a running gag.
That's kind of what Joseph had said as well, but I'm trying to figure out why dog biscuits would be on this, why there's like dog biscuits sitting there.
Well, things like that, and the fishing hat with all the hooks in it and stuff. I mean, that's all Bob. Bob came up with that, you know?
What did you learn from him working with him? I mean, that seems like just, that history of Hollywood and all of those roles he was in. What did you sort of take away from that? Did you just sit back and go, okay, Let me see what I can figure out here.
Well, he made me a better actor working with him because he was so terrific and so focused and right there, and learned about when to infuse it with comedy and to play those beats, and when situations got tough in parts of the show, not to play the comedy when comedy didn't work, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they
learned that from Bob. And you know, I'll tell you something. Bob always thought of himself as a writer first, a director second, and then an actor lastly. And that's the way he conducted his life on set with us. I mean, he was always a writer first. We rewrote so many of those scenes. And I learned a lot about writing from Bob.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned, too, about him deciding when comedy works and when it doesn't. I mean, you think of scenes like where he's sitting there with another FBI agent who's basically going to turn into a bad guy and, you know, abscond with all these funds and embezzle. And this look comes on his face like he realizes he's not kidding. Like one minute they're shooting pool and drinking beer, and next thing you know, it's like, oh, should I turn my best friend in? It's just, those elements are just amazing when you consider the show. It's so much more than a superhero show.
Yeah.
Connie Selica, great chemistry with Connie Selica.
You know, the story on that goes, and this is right from the horse's mouth from Steve, is that you know, Connie was not signed on for the series at the beginning of that pilot, but within the first week watching the dailies, he said he turned to his the other producers, and he said, "Man, this chemistry is just too good. We want to have this girl." So they made a deal with Connie at the end of the first week to put her on the show permanently. But she was not originally signed to do the series.
Your scenes with her, especially in the pilot, let's talk a little bit about that. Just sometimes you're there, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're trying to save Maxwell, and it's just amazing how you guys have these conversations that are like so many layers to them. How much preparation did you put into that? Is this a table reads, or are you kind of hitting the, you know, hitting the set cold?
Initially, there was a lot of that going on, but a lot of that was just the freaking chemistry between Connie and I and Bob. I mean, it just one of those things that came naturally, you know?
Yeah.
Not too long ago, and I was just remarking about this the other day to a friend, you know, Connie, Bob, and I got together in 08. We went to the San Diego Comic-Con to launch the comic book, which was quite interesting. When I'm walking down the hall there upstairs, and Connie grabs my arm. She said, "Do you think anyone will be there?" And we walk in the room. There's like 2,000 people sitting in the room. It was a great ego booster for all of us.
Yeah.
But let me digress for a second. The chemistry was just amazing. So there wasn't too much work that had to go on. That's just how we behaved around each other, you know?
Yeah. And just even those scenes, I mean, she's not this damsel in distress. I mean, she's brainy. She gets in there. One of my favorite scenes in the pilot is after you take care of the bad guys at the end, you fling them against the wall, their guns drop. Because we're watching this thing, and my wife, it's been forever since she saw it, and she's like, "Grab the guns." And it's Connie that grabs the guns. Because you always say, "Why don't they grab the guns before they walk out?" And it's Connie's character. It's Pam Davidson that reaches over and starts grabbing the guns.
Yeah.
It's just some brilliant moments there. Was she a practical joker?
Oh, Connie had the wickedest sense of humor of any gal I've ever known.
Like, how wicked? Because I've read some things that seem very strange. Can you confirm some of these? Like,
did it get
pretty dark?
Got pretty dark every day. Well, two things. On set, she would always tell the bluest jokes in the morning right at the beginning of the day at 6 o'clock in the morning. So that set the tone for the day. But in her personal life, she would do these wacky things and do these, like one time she said that she sat at the bottom of the stairs before her husband was coming in, and she covered herself with blood and stuff as if she had broken her neck falling down the stairs. That was funny to Connie.
Okay, this is what I was – that's what I was wondering, if that was actually true. She actually did those things?
Well, so she tells me. I mean, I never saw it myself. But
did she ever get you with anything?
No, I can't remember. You know, she's such a sweetheart, such a lovely gal.
Yeah, it'd be nice if we could see you guys in another project at some point too. Favorite episodes, favorite moments shooting the series? Anything jump to mind of just events that you really liked?
Fastball early on, that was kind of really, really funny. You know, the way the shows used to be constructed, Steve told me, is that they'd find a funny premise. Ego is a really funny premise when it gets out of control. So that was all about Fastball. How Ralph gets carried away throwing this 95-mile-an-hour fastball, and he starts to think he's a superstar. The other one that comes to mind, I mean, there was so many, Beast in Black was a pretty good thing, where it was a jump back and forth in time. It was kind of a scary episode that we did. I love the episode of when they think they have the plague and they're looking at themselves in the mirror and they think that they're sick with the plague. I thought that that was hilariously funny.
The one where he gets supercharged and like all the metal comes flying at him.
That's pretty funny. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And so you guys were nominated in the comedy category for Emmys, right?
I didn't even realize we had been nominated, for God's sakes, you know?
Didn't
realize that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, yeah, and that shows the strength of the show and the strength of the writing and the characters and everything. A lot of different powers coming into play throughout the course of the series. Anything that you contributed? Did you have any ideas or like, hey, let's try this out? Or what were some of your favorite powers that Ralph kind of got over the years?
I played a little bit with ideas in the comic book. I mean, I always thought about that, which never came to fruition. I always thought about that belt buckle that he had on his belt as a Chinese puzzle box, and it somehow could disassemble and become some sort of portal to another world, or use it kind of the way Superman used his secret fortress, you know, and the crystals would become something, you know, give him would foreshadow certain things and give him information. I thought maybe that belt buckle could have done something like that, but that never happened, unfortunately.
Or the little green guys could have put the instruction book in there. That would have made more sense.
They could have done that.
Don't give him a suitcase. He's going to lose that. Challenges to filming. A lot of flight scenes, obviously in its infancy as well, some of these things as you're going through. What were some of the challenges that you had while you were shooting, and even the stunt work. The stunt work is amazing in the
Yeah, season. that was the wonderful, a dear friend of mine, Dennis Matalow and Dennis Danger. And we kind of came up with that whole thing. He'd do these amazing stunts and land literally inches away from me. And then I'd pop up from behind something and people would say, oh my God, Bill just did that. But it was always Dennis doing those major stunts, and then I'd be there right by him. Sometimes he'd land on me and I would pop up. That was the way that was constructed. It was pretty ingenious at the time. It was new because I don't recall other TV series doing that quite the way we were doing it.
Did you find yourself in any dangerous situations or even with the flying harnesses or anything?
You know, I just remember we used to work with helicopters all the time. And I got to hang on a helicopter strut. And
you're fly. On one. I mean, that episode, you're on it, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how far up? Because Linda Carter said she did the same thing. I mean, she jumped on a helicopter and nobody said no. But you can never get away with that today. But how far up did you get?
You couldn't do it today. Couldn't do it today. But then, I mean, I was hanging off helicopters and stuff. And there was no, we weren't tethered off or anything. You know, we were just, that was just us.
Did you volunteer for that, or did somebody say, hey?
Hell yes, I love to fly, yeah.
How high up were you on the strut there?
Oh, God, high enough to kill you.
You know, but no worries at all. This could be the end of, literally the end of my career.
No, not at all.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, because that's a great shot.
Years later, I did Circus of the Stars, and I did that death wheel, that hamster wheel that goes up and down. I climbed on the inside and the outside, did a handstand on the top. That was much more dangerous, believe me.
That's right. Oh, Circus of the Stars, where have you gone? That would be, I wonder if we'll ever see a remake of that. What were your thoughts when the whole Ralph Hinckley, Ralph Hanley controversy came into play? Because that you had the unfortunate timing of premiering shortly before the assassination attempt on President Reagan. How much of that did you know was going on with the name change?
We knew something happened that day. It was, I remember being on set. It was in the afternoon, I believe. And I got a call right then, and there was changes. The name was dropped immediately, and we were Henley for like one episode or something. And then it was Mike Perret came up with that. He called me Mr. H in class, and it just stuck. They said, that's it. And from that point on, I was always Mr. H.
Because I think even in one episode, there's the name plate on the door was changed mm-hmm. to Hanley too. But I mean, how much of that played into what you guys were doing, and how much Steven, did he have any input into that, or it kind of reverted back to Hinckley after a while?
I don't really know what went on behind the scenes, you know?
Okay. I mean, but that didn't bother you guys at all? Just like whatever?
No, of course not.
Speaking of names, other than Captain Gonzo, did you or Steven ever give your character a superhero name?
No, that's, you know, that's very interesting. Over the years, people have said that. You know, Ralph never really had a superhero name, you know?
If you were going to give Ralph a superhero name, what would it be? Have you ever thought about that?
No, haven't thought about that. Isn't that funny? In the last Man of Steel movie, they did not mention Superman either. She was about to say Superman, and they bleeped it out. Something happened. That was a funny scene.
There's a little feedback on the microphone or something. Yeah. When you were shooting the series, at any point did you think, oh, this is going to become much, much bigger than
no, I
realized.
Mean, you got to remember, this is the time period. I mean, there was no internet. There was no such thing as a convention to celebrate superheroes or comic books or Star Trek or any of those kinds of things. So nobody had any idea. I mean, there was no DVDs, for God's sakes. We don't get paid for DVD, you know, DVDs. So
any problems while you were filming? I mean, what were some of the struggles you had to go through? You mentioned the suit, that you hated wearing the suit. Did you ever just come to terms with, like, okay, this is, I'm just going to kind of embrace the character? Or when did you embrace the character?
Well, the hardest thing about, I mean, I always loved Ralph. I'm very fond of that character. And everybody on that set. I mean, it's really true. When you're shooting a series for a while, you become a family because you spend more time there than you do at home. The hardest thing doing a series, and that one in particular, was the fact that I was on set 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day, and so you never had a break. Bob and Connie periodically would get off, and I'd be on stage flying around, hanging off a green screen, you know? So it was, I was tired at the end of three and a half years. I mean, I was beat, you know.
You were ready to let the character go?
I was ready to take a long vacation, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned the sort of backdoor pilot, The Greatest American Heroine. It went to NBC in 1986. What did the cast think of that? You mentioned Robert kind of wanted it to continue on. You appeared in it. Connie Selleck appeared in it.
Yeah.
Kind of gave at least a very nice bookend to the character, gave you a nice out there. But what did you guys think of that project as it stands? Because now it's kind of like the unofficial final episode of the series.
Yeah, I don't know. I hope that it worked. I wanted it to work for Robert's sake. You know, I thought it would have been great, you know, and for Steve and everything, you know. But
did you like what they did with your character? He kind of like, you know, kind of made him a diva. That's why they had to take the suit away, because you know, he's like, you know, you're not worthy of it. It went to your head. Everybody found out about him, and he hit the talk show circuits. And I mean, were you okay with sort of how Ralph Hinckley ended up?
That was pretty funny. Yeah, we all laugh at that. Yeah, I was okay with it, you know. Okay.
And you get to hang around with the little green guys again.
Yeah, it's fun.
So we mentioned the Greatest American Hero comic book. You've got these, you know, the continuation thing. It's possible it's going to be rebooted as a movie. What do you think about the possibility of that happening? And even Nathan Fillion has mentioned he might be interested in the role. Has he ever talked about it with you?
No, I saw him on set because Dennis Matalone, who was our stunt coordinator on Hero, is the stunt coordinator on Castle. And so I went down. I've been down there a few times to visit, and you know, never really gave it much thought. Now I think he's getting a little long in the tooth. In all honesty, I think that they'd cast a much younger guy now if they do it.
Well, and Steven had a role on Castle, as himself, or at least a version of himself,
yeah,
too. So I'm just kind of wondering, did any of those conversations take place, and where did you kind of leave it before he unfortunately passed away in 2010?
I wasn't privy to any of those conversations, if they did occur. Yeah, I was very close to Steve, yeah, right up until the end. Yeah.
Would you be interested in a reboot, or having any part in it, or writing it, or producing it?
As I said earlier, you know, when Steve passed, his entire library is still being run by Mike DeBelko, his longtime partner. But that show and the licensing fell to 20th Century Fox, as I believe. So they're really in control of that. Maybe Steve's oldest daughter is trying to get it rebooted for television. I thought maybe with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. having the success it's had, that maybe it would be easier to get it on the air.
What would you do with it? I mean, you rebooted it in the comic book, so you sort of took the original pilot and brought it into modern day. But how would you approach it if you were handling the project?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I'd be asked at this point. I'm a little long in the tooth, and I think that's up to much younger guys than me with newer thoughts and ideas to bring to bear. You know?
Do you think The Greatest American Hero could work today? Because it's interesting when you get Captain America, the movie, but it plays in places like Ukraine and South Korea and Russia. They change it to the title, you know, First Avenger. They don't call it Captain America. Do you think The Greatest American Hero would work today and worldwide?
I don't see why it wouldn't. I mean, it was a very likable character. It really depends. You'd have to have you'd have to cast it correctly. You'd have to have that actor, and there's many out there, you know, that could play that role.
You've been in the business long enough. Who would you cast? You've been around, and it's your character. So who would you want to see fill the red jammies and the red boots?
Oh God, that's.
You had to have given it some thought. I mean, you can't, because you.
Well, years ago, you know, I read a script that Steven had a great hand in. They were going to do a feature film some years ago, and I read it, and we were talking, and I thought Owen Wilson at the time would be a wonderful Ralph. But now he's gotten a little old, and it's because you want a guy that's in his, you know, late 20s, early 30s. I don't know. The Bill Maxwell roles, I don't know. There's so many guys, you know.
I thought Joseph Culp would be perfect for the Bill Maxwell role. Just takes over the role for his father.
Yeah, he would be.
I mean, he's got the voice, he's got the cadence. He's got the genes, so I think that would be an amazing thing. What do you think about Grace American Hero and all the pop culture references? We've got Seinfeld and Sheldon Cooper on Big Bang Theory. He's wearing the shirts, flying the colors. Do you kind of get a kick out of this, or is it just like, oh, go away?
No, because I don't associate it with me. It's they're paying an homage to the show and to the creators and what it represented to them in their youth. You know, that it impacted them, you know, and so I don't take it personally that it reflects, is any kind of a reflection on me.
What does the show represent to you, and why do you think it was so successful? Why did it resonate like it did?
I don't know. I think it came along at the right, it was one of those things that came along at the right time. It was like, why was Carrie so successful, the original film? I just was in the right place at the right time and had the right people. The casting was great. And America and the world was ready for it at the time. That's all I can say. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about some of your latest projects. What are you currently working on?
I just did a great project with a dear friend of mine, Chris Felina. We did a film called Sparks, which was a noir thriller, a superhero that gets these powers, but we didn't have a $250 million budget, you know. So we had to explore it differently, we became a very introverted film in exploring that dark side, you know, people using the powers for dark as opposed to using them for the good, and what that does to people, you know, how it impinges on their lives. So I did that, and I had some great success out there, and that's available out there. I have another film coming out called The Unwanted, which is a really interesting look at a family relationship. A father sequesters his daughter in a rural area of the South, and what takes place there. It's kind of a very, very creepy thriller horror film. And I have another film coming out called Subterranean, which is a really interesting look at, a father who keeps his son captive for 25 years as an experiment, and then lets him go in the middle of the city when he's about 25 years old. I did that with Bug Hall, and that's going to be a very interesting film. The Unwanted I did with Hannah Fearman, a wonderful actress out of Atlanta that's going to do some great things.
What attracts you to a project?
Nowadays, it's the script and the director, you know. Brett Wood did The Unwanted. Interesting guy. He's done some very small kind of films in the South, but he had a very interesting style and tone to his films, and this was by far his most commercial venture. And again, this guy Matt Miller out of Montana that I did Subterranean with, very, very interesting young filmmaker, who really impressed me with some of his short films that I saw. This was his first feature film, and the guy knocked me out. Working with Chris Felina, same thing, you know. Chris is a guy who has done some wonderful work in the commercial world, shoots a lot of commercials. So it's typically the script and the director.
Can we look forward to more voiceover work? I know you've done some voiceover work for Batman the Animated Series, Justice League, and Batman the Brave and the Bold. Do we got some more of that coming down the pipe?
I don't know about that. I think my last venture with that over at Warner Brothers was I played Hawkman. Mm-hmm. And I think they were disenchanted because my voice was not deep enough and not manly enough. You know, I had this kind of boyish quality to me. But
did you get notes?
Yeah, I heard about it after the fact. And I go, well, you know, there's nothing, not too much I can do about that. You know,
it's already done. Well, you did the Green Guardsman.
Yeah.
Maybe we can look for maybe the Marvel world. Maybe you can head over to the Marvel world and do some voiceover work for there.
Mark Hamill's got all those VO jobs locked up, you know?
It's not the first time your paths crossed. As lovers of Star Wars extras, DVD extras know. What about, how can fans find out more about you? Website, Facebook, Twitter? Where is William Catt these days online?
Yeah, I have a Facebook. A Greatest American Hero Facebook page that my friend Marcy Boku runs, and we're in communication fairly often and talk about things. We post things there that's coming up, and she does a great job with that page. So you can find me there.
Are you on Twitter at all?
No, I don't do Twitter and all that stuff. I don't have I don't have time. I appreciate it, you know. But doing all that social media, that's all I do. I sit around all day and do that stuff, you know.
Well, fans can definitely find you on Facebook then. And also, my fellow podcaster, Mitch Halleck, he runs the Connecticut Comic Con. You are going to be there August 15th through the 17th.
I am, yes.
Memorable fan experiences. You've been to a lot of these conventions now. What's the reaction you get from the fans when they're coming up to you?
I get more out of it than they get out of it, because you know, these fans of comic book conventions and horror conventions and whatnot, they are the best. You know, they come out and they want to visit, and they want to spend some time with the people that were very impressionable in their younger days, and it just such a thrill for me. I get so much back from that. It's just mainly the kids. I love the kids, and I love the guys that come up and dressed in suits. These one giant man with a wig on and just dwarfed me, and he had the Greatest American Hero suit on, and we took pictures together. That was kind of fun. I like kids with special needs that come up to me, and I've made them smile and given them a little bit of joy in their life, and I get to visit with them. Those are real special moments to me.
After all these years, it seems like you've embraced the character now, with some years in between and wearing the suit.
Yeah.
And I'm putting that on. Well, you know what? You once described The Greatest American Hero is a show that appeals to the 14-year-old and all of us. I will say this. I was 14 when it premiered, and today I feel like I'm 14 years old all over again.
Oh, hey, man. Well, you are the best. Thank you for taking so much time. You're so generous and gracious.
William Catt, I thank you for joining us today on Comic Book Central.
Okay, thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Unproduced episodes of The Greatest American Hero, written by Robert Culp. Oh, man, I would so love to see those in a TV series or movie reboot, maybe even a continuation of the comic book series. Let's keep hope alive, Comic Book Central Nation. Hey, my thanks again to William Catt for joining me in the lair today. Be sure to keep up with William on his Facebook page. It's The Greatest American Hero, William Catt. There you'll find out about William's latest projects, including the Sparks graphic novel, which is now available as a digital download. I'll put those links on the show notes, as well as the Connecticut Comic-Con link, where you can meet William in person. Don't forget about that this August. Be sure to keep up on the latest episodes of Comic Book Central online at comicbookcentral.net. And you can also subscribe to the show in iTunes. If you can take a moment to rate and review the show while you're there, I really appreciate it. Let me know what you think. And be sure to hashtag share the lair on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork, and tweet me at comicbookctrl. You can also send me an email, joe@comicbookcentral.net. Well, folks, I'm putting on the red jammies and exercising the power of invisibility by disappearing for today. But I will be reappearing at Monster Bash with Derek Cook this weekend in Pittsburgh. Remember, if you're in the area, be sure to catch it. And of course, I'll be back in 1 week, because next week on Comic Book Central, I will take to the skies once again, but this time with a superhero that had a few less flying issues than Ralph Hinckley. Joining me next time will be the Boy of Steel from the Superboy television series. Gerard Christopher will be my guest. Until then, have a terrific week. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
You're not doing it right. You gotta run like 3 steps and jump with your hands out in front of you.